Welcome. I'm your host, Henry Arslanian, and welcome to the Future of Money podcast. My goal with this podcast is very simple. It's to go deep in some of the biggest ideas, trends, developments we are seeing in the field of crypto, and hopefully empower you with this information, and then let you make your own decision on what their impact can be on the future of money and finance. To do this, I invite each week one of the leading figures of the global crypto community to have a one-on-one conversation amongst crypto aficionados and discuss some of these topics. My guest today is Hugh Madden, the group CEO of BC Group, which is the parent company of OSL, Asia's only publicly listed, SFC-regulated, and Big Four audited digital assets platform. One thing, by the way, you may not know about Hugh is that he's a big sailor. And believe it or not, he can reverse park a 32-ton sailboat easily. So there you go. You thought that getting involved in crypto was difficult. Try to reverse park a 32-ton sailboat. Hugh, thank you. Great to have you with us today on the Future of Money podcast.
My pleasure. I'm very pleased to be on the show.
So Hugh, before we kick it off, can you share about with our audience a bit about your background? And you know how you actually discovered crypto from your early days of banking, and also tell us more about the BC Group and OSL.
Sure. Yeah. So I spent a lifetime in technology and investment banking, and during the global financial crisis, I was kind of not a big believer in the issues around bailouts, bailing out one's neighbor. I thought there was a lot of moral hazards that we saw with our traditional centrally planned markets. And when I saw Bitcoin, I thought, wow, this is an amazing breath of fresh air. Even though I'm a technologist and the technology and security concepts around Bitcoin are amazing, actually, it was more of an ethical reasons that drew me to Bitcoin. So that was back in 2013 when myself and a couple of partners started our first foray into digital assets and crypto. Fast forward to now, BC Group is our main board listed company here on the Hong Kong Exchange, and its largest subsidiary is OSL, which has become a digital asset powerhouse. OSL has an exchange, a brokerage, a unique custody offering, all are regulated under the SFC, which is quite, I'd say, the most robust framework in the world. But on top of that, all of those three product lines were built from the start to be software as a service products. So other financial institutions that wish to take digital assets to their customers, they license our technology. And some of the most famous ones are Singapore's amazing bank, DBS, which uses our technology. And also we recently announced a joint venture with StanChart, taking digital assets to Europe and the UK.
I think I have to say it's been quite a remarkable journey you guys have been on from a whole BC Group OSL perspective. And really big congratulations on some of the recent wins that you just mentioned. And you know, one thing I want to talk about Hugh today, one thing I really want to cover is really the future of regulated exchanges. There's obviously a lot of noise around the world obviously there's a lot of exchanges that are becoming regulated. There's a whole universe of them that are not being regulated and staying in that kind of unregulated path. Obviously, for you guys, from an OSL perspective, you took a really the regulated path. Can you share with us what was the idea behind and why did you take this route instead of the unregulated one?
Sure. It was my view that regulations were a certainty, an absolute certainty here. In some ways, around regulators looking to manage AML risks. In other ways, regulators concerned with consumer protection. But one way or another, I was certain that this industry would be heavily regulated, and certainly the centralized operators. So anyone with a clear operations, holding client monies and holding client crypto, clearly need to be regulated. And we had the view that there will be a changing of the guard as all of the major jurisdictions eventually do enforce regulations, then we'll see market share go to those who have taken the time and the effort and the expense in order to obtain necessary licensing.
So what do you think then is the future of unregulated exchanges? You think they'll be able to stay in this unregulated universe, or I think the time will come they will need to come and start complying with the regulatory frameworks of whatever country they wish to be involved in?
centralized exchanges will need to be regulated. And in some ways, given the losses with hacks and other events we've seen over the last 5 years, I think you can argue it's proper that someone holding clients' life savings should be subject to audits and have some scrutiny from a regulator. We've seen too many people get hurt in this industry. Now, that said, there is plenty of room in the decentralized world. So it's a DeFi and basically all of the self-custody options. I believe that the introduction of regulations is going to cause a massive boom. I think we're already seeing that in DeFi, you know, where people choose to hold their own coins. And obviously, given my career, I'm also a massive, massive believer and I passionately love that whole world as well. And so I think we'll see enormous innovation happening in that space, where operators who are too small to provide the investment they need to be licensed, they will then inevitably need to develop to be decentralized, where they're not holding customer keys. And then I think we'll see huge innovation and a lot of exciting movement in that industry as well, which I quite like. So we've got regulated institutions being able to enter the space through regulated operators such as OSL. And then we'll see the smaller, more innovative, faster moving elements of the industry, innovating at pace in the DeFi space. And of course, as they mature, these concepts will come over the moat and into the centralized exchange.
So you don't see from your perspective as a regulated centralized exchange, you don't see decentralized exchanges as a competitor yet, or you see it's complementary?
For us, not yet, because the client base that we target on can only operate with a regulated operator. So for a bank or a private bank or a regulated asset manager seeking to enter this space and transact in this space, they need a counterpart as regulated. They need to be able to manage their AML risks by trading with the regulated counterpart, and their client onboarding teams and their compliance teams will require a certain level of protection that in the current regulated player space they only see as they can receive those protections through working with regulated partners. So for our business in the short term, no. Over the longer term, I think blockchain and crypto will become a part of the fabric of the internet itself, and so certainly no one can stay still in this business. That's one of the most exciting things about it. You have to continuously change and innovate to be remain competitive.
But you know, from your perspective, obviously you've been dealing a lot with regulators. We'll come into that in a second. Do you believe regulators will try to regulate DeFi? And if so, how do you think they can even do this?
Yeah, obviously the infrastructure bill going through the states at the moment is a source of dismay, for all of us. I think at the end of the day, it's a bit like BitTorrent. When you're needing to enforce against a third of the population, for example, in the freer countries, it doesn't make sense. And so I think it's inevitable that it will be impossible to heavily regulate DeFi. So I think eventually those efforts are doomed to fail. But it's certainly a challenge, and it's forcing the very rapid evolution and sophistication of regulators worldwide.
It's interesting because I have to say, I remember when the DeFi was less than $1 billion in total value lock in January 2020, and I really didn't expect it to grow so quickly. And I think you're right. I mean, how they're going to be able to regulate DeFi will be very interesting and frankly challenging endeavor, considering it's open source and anybody can copy the code and start again in another one next door, right? So it's going to be very, very interesting. One thing I want to ask you, Hugh, is obviously, as a regulated centralized exchange, and you guys offer white label services as well, you'd be dealing with a lot of financial institutions, a lot of banks, traditional financial institutions in recent months. What do you think are the biggest challenges traditional financial institutions are facing when they're trying to enter the crypto space?
I think educating their internal organization, their compliance teams, their legal teams, their sales staff, I think it's mainly educating themselves. And what we've seen, it just takes time. And some of the engagements that we've been fortunate to win, they were multi-year sales process with lots of hands-on workshops, working through how these transactions would work from every department in a bank, you know, whether it be compliance, legal, technology, security, marketing, sales, trading. Every department needs to be walked through and become comfortable and satisfied and ready to release, you know, what's really perhaps the first brand new instrument, you know, through these organizations in perhaps 30 years.
It's going to be very interesting, but you're right. I think education is a very big challenge, and it's something that I see all the time as well. Often that is the first barrier. You're always inherently afraid of something you do not understand, right? So I think it creates a lot of issues from that perspective. But do you see, let's say, obviously, so far, OSL has been working with a lot of these partners, right, with a lot of these financial institutions. Do you believe that some of these banks will be able to build their own in-house solutions and be a competitor to some of these crypto-native crypto exchanges, including OSL?
Absolutely, I do. Particularly when it comes to regulated monies. So 401ks, people's or Australia's superannuation, people's retirement savings. So when you've got a population's retirement savings being managed by regulated asset managers, there's a lot of obligations and duty of care obligations around those asset managers. They need a large institution, large enough that they can be comfortable with the risk of trading with that institution, and also satisfied that there'll be adequate protections in place, whether it be market surveillance, whether it be market integrity, where there's just a whole host of things that a large regulated asset manager holding billions of dollars in the world's retirement savings, they need real institutions to trade against safely. Certainly, it'd be much more challenging in the absolute mass retail market. I think where the banks have built up a really strong digital channel and they're managing to compete with time on their users' phones, if they're managing to compete with big tech, then they certainly have a chance as well as winning some of that market share. As where people's funds reside is where they're very happy to trade if it means less clicks.
Yeah, exactly. Very, very interesting. Let's see, I think, how that evolves, but I think you're right. That's going to be a very interesting developments to watch. One thing I want to ask you as well, Hugh, is obviously the BC Group is a listed company. So now you're literally in charge of a publicly listed company. How has that changed? What is the main difference you've seen? We're obviously being private to public, but also did it change the way you run the business since being public?
Yeah, I have to operate in a very different scale. I guess as a small private company in the digital asset space, you know, we're talking time to market, expectations 1 to 3 months, very rapid product development cycles. Probably realistically, with such fast turnaround, taking a bit more risk in the sense that the scale is just not as large, and mistakes might not be as costly. But here as a listed and licensed operator, any small mistake can result in days of reports to our regulators and similarly, with regards to any new product or any changes to our operations, we have to think very hard and carefully about whether our auditor is going to be comfortable with that. So really, the lifeblood, the bedrock of trust that you have as a listed company with these high levels of corporate governance, that all culminates in your audit. And so in our case, of course, we've got a big four auditor. We were their first listed crypto company, I believe, worldwide. They look at all of our financial records, and where it's a blockchain record, they will go and independently verify all of that data against public blockchain sources. I think that's an absolutely astounding level of assurance. If only you could have went and looked at Wirecard and had someone independently verify all of their finances against public blockchain data, it would have been impossible for that situation to arise. So I think very, very high level of assurance, which is good for investors, it's good for our clients, but it also dictates a slower and more careful and also larger kind of approach to taking our products to the market.
You know, it's interesting. Obviously, I think there's a lot more regulatory issues you're dealing with because since being listed, like as you mentioned, right? What is your view on some of the upcoming regulatory developments that may affect the industry? For example, one of them is what's happening with the Financial Action Task Force, the FATF, and its travel rules. Do you think a travel rule will have a positive, neutral, or negative impact on the future of centralized crypto exchanges?
So the travel rule, which for those who aren't aware, there's a global regulatory body where all large jurisdictions collaborate and set standards for anti-money laundering and counter-terrorist financing controls. And pretty much all countries will follow these recommendations. So the Financial Action Task Force, a couple of years ago now, introduced a requirement to do just what's called the travel rule, which is when a payment is sent from one operator to another operator. You know, in the existing banking world, it's over the SWIFT network. And they've introduced that for cryptocurrencies. So when a customer of one exchange sends funds to another operator in the space, when it being crypto, there's an obligation to record and potentially report the beneficiary details. Now, this has had two very marked effects. First of all, FATF required it, but no member states except Hong Kong that I'm aware actually implemented it as a requirement. But the fact that there was a regulator, there was licensed operators now that the regulated traditional institutions could interact with, that to me, that's what caused an absolute boom. That's what brought the banks and the asset managers to the space. So the fact that that risk was being dramatically reduced as a result of the regulation changes. On the other hand, it's a lot of friction. It slows down transactions, asking clients for more information when they just want to send a Bitcoin transaction somewhere. It's a massive amount of friction. So first of all, we'll see all of the mass retail kind of operators stay as unregulated as long as they can, because this will pretty much make them non-competitive for mass retail. But in the long run, maybe it's 2 years, maybe it's 3 years, all major jurisdictions will require it. And then technology solutions will make it a lot less painful. But it will still also cause a continued flight and investment into DeFi, into decentralized space. And so hence why I'm a huge believer we're going to continue to see just enormous amounts of innovation and activity happening in the decentralized space.
I think the whole DeFi ecosystem and how it's evolving is going to be very, very interesting. And actually, you know, about institutional investors, right? So obviously, we are seeing an increased number of institutional investors come and enter the crypto space. What is the biggest challenge you're seeing institutional investors are having when looking at crypto? We talked previously about the banks and how the lack of education is the biggest hurdle. When it comes to investors themselves, what do you think is the biggest challenge? Is it education or is something else?
A lot of it has been sufficiently reputable. I guess I'm a bit, my focus here is high net worths, private banks, family offices, large funds. And for that space, it's asset protection. So these sorts of players have legal teams looking very hard and very carefully at the legal structure of the partner they're operating with. So how are the client assets stored in the event of an insolvency or another similar event? What's the legal structure of those funds? What's the debt seniority? In the traditional equities world, you have more major jurisdictions have got a very, very important protection, which is called client asset segregation. What this means is that the not only the funds, client funds versus the operator's funds kept separately, they're kept separately in a legal structure which means those funds are protected and remain the property of the client, even in the event of an insolvency and similar situations. That's been happening for decades and decades in equities, and no institution would do business without that protection. In the crypto space, I'm not aware of anywhere yet except for our operation under the SFC here in Hong Kong, which offers legally client asset segregation. Now there's other factors as well which matters for these teams beyond that: security, compliance controls, size of the balance sheet to assess viability of the partner. So these are all kind of features that are basically showstoppers for an institutional client.
Actually, I want to ask you about that because you mentioned about Hong Kong, right? Obviously, you are physically based in Hong Kong as we speak, and there's obviously the OSL as a business has a lot of its roots and infrastructure in Hong Kong. What is your view of Hong Kong as a future global crypto hub? Obviously, there's been a lot of regulatory frameworks that have been given. There's been a lot of policy decisions that have been made. How do you see the future of Hong Kong when it comes to its pace, to its role in the global crypto ecosystem?
I think, we also have an operation in Singapore, and we were a very early applicant to the license framework there as well, and currently grandfathered under the PSA. So very familiar with operating in both jurisdictions, and they've both got their strengths and weaknesses. Hong Kong's particular historical strength, aside from being a gateway to China, has been a very high level of corporate governance, which particularly in a region such as Asia, when you've got a jurisdiction with a strong rule of law and the exchange and the securities regulator having a very high level of corporate governance, all heavily focused on consumer protection. To me, that is what Hong Kong's been built on. It's not rapidly bringing out 100 new Ubers and quickly innovating in the technology space. I would love it to be the case, but realistically, that hasn't been Hong Kong's strongest point. Hong Kong has been able to grow a base as a financial center with very strong corporate governance. So applying that concept then to our industry, I think Hong Kong can continue to win that large regulated business. Large funds can operate in the space from Hong Kong and be in a regulated manner. And Hong Kong was very quick to help the industry, actually. So regulated funds, a couple of years ago now, the securities regulator here said regulated funds can have up to 10% of cryptocurrencies in their portfolio without needing an additional license. To me, that's actually huge. What other jurisdiction can you go and have? Now you've got really heavily regulated asset managers, funds that can do that. And of course, they also released a digital asset specific fund manager license as well. Which there's a small handful in Hong Kong. But I expect to see some super exciting products coming out of that space, because that allows people to face a heavily regulated asset manager, and the asset manager can do amazing things underneath. Like they can go and interact with DeFi or staking and give a very, very safe and regulated channel for investors to access that space. So in all those areas, very strong capital markets, regulated money. I expect Hong Kong to continue doing well. Fostering stimulation in small fintech outfits? No, not at all. The barrier to entry is way too high. It's millions and millions of dollars, large team, some things like mandatory insurance. The SFC regime requires almost full insurance of all assets held under custody. And insurance in the crypto space is quite expensive. So a small player just isn't going to be able to build and innovate centralized style products. But we've got some of the largest firms in the space that have been here. Now they've got two options. They can move their operations out of the country, or they can double down on decentralized finance, on DeFi, and don't be a centralized operator. And for me, that one's the most exciting, frankly, because I love the industry, and the faster the faster we see DeFi just becoming part of the internet, its financial transactions are just part and parcel of the internet, then it's going to be a pretty exciting world.
I can feel the passion for DeFi there. You are. I can feel it, so it's good. Before we go to the fire round questions, I want to ask you a question about hiring, because obviously there's, I'm sure, a lot of people now looking at entering the crypto space. As a CEO, what are you looking for when you're hiring somebody? Are you looking at their credentials, passion, interest for crypto? What is really the main elements you're looking for to hire, especially for people coming from traditional finance?
Passion is the absolute number one. It's just the most important thing that people love what we're doing, love coming to work. You know, anytime I'm talking to anyone, staff or anyone, I say, when you get out of bed in the morning, do you look forward to going to your job? If the answer is no, well, life's too short, go and do another job. If the answer is yes, well, it's a very good chance you're going to excel at that job, because people naturally excel about things that they're passionate. That said, now, yeah, being listed, heavily regulated, we do need quite a large team of so-called seasoned professionals, people who know how to operate large regulated businesses. And I can understand the needs of our regulated clients. We do, that's kind of a necessary part of our capability now. But on the other hand, from a technology perspective, we love energetic graduates. We've been hiring as many graduates every year as my managers will let me. They always say you do need bandwidth to actually manage graduates, but I've always been so impressed with the performance of Hong Kong graduates after a year or two of training, and so that's also a linchpin to our resourcing strategy.
That's amazing. Passion again comes over and over. It's incredible. That's often the one thing needed to do. So, okay, before we kick off, I want to have the bell is back, and I'm going to go through a quick fire round of questions. So I'll ask you some little short questions. I want like one or two word answers. Ready?
Okay.
Let's kick it off. So what is your favorite thing to do in Hong Kong, where you're based?
Family time.
Here you go. I know you're a big sailor. If there's one sailing competition you would love to do, which one is that?
Sydney to Hobart.
Whoa, that's an interesting one. Here we go. What do you do on your free time when you're not working?
Squash, sailing, family.
Here we go. Come back to the main. That's good. What is your favorite video game that you played as a kid?
Bubble.
Bubble. Here you go. Nostalgic times here. When you go to a bar, what is your favorite drink?
Jack Daniels and Coke.
Jack and Coke. Here you go. If you had to spend an evening just watching YouTube or Netflix, what is your favorite show to watch?
Vikings.
Oh, here we go. Here we go. If you can have lunch with one other CEO of any company, any business, which CEO you want to have lunch with?
I think it would be Bill Gates, mainly not for technology, but he seems to be heavily involved in renewable and carbon kind of industries, and I've got a great passion there. And I feel like there's going to be a lot of the successes are going to come out of the private sector, wealthy private sector, who can move faster and more assertively than governments can.
Interesting. Very good point. Bill Gates, here we go. Now that he's divorced, he probably has a bit more time as well. So if you had, okay, one more question. If you were not in the crypto industry, what other industry you would like to be in?
I think the renewable sector.
Renewables, huh? Here we go. If you had to make a bet, is Satoshi a man or a woman, and from what country he or she is from?
Oh, yes. I think English-Japanese man.
Really? English-Japanese man? Wow, here we go. Love to hear more about that. What's the basis of that? But maybe for another podcast. You, two more questions. What is keeping you up at night right now?
my small children.
And you, if what is the what you, your belief for the price of Bitcoin will have on by December 31st, 2021 and in 5 years from now?
Call it 100,000 and then 650,000.
Pretty bullish perspective there, huh?
Well, like it can go up and it can go down. So that's the one thing I am certain of. It won't stay the same.
That was Hugh Madden, the Group CEO of BC Group. Thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
For everybody listening today from around the world, make sure to click subscribe if you like this podcast. There'll be a new episode that will be released every 2 weeks. And also, if you want to stay on top of the latest developments on crypto and the future of money, make sure to also follow me on LinkedIn and Twitter, especially for my weekly crypto capsule show, where I summarize the global crypto developments you need to know in less than 60 seconds. And don't forget to subscribe on LinkedIn to my weekly newsletter. We have over 40,000 subscribers now, called The Future of Money, where I share 3 big ideas on the future of money that you need to know each week. And last but not least, it's very important, my YouTube channel, where I have not only videos of previous interviews, and the one with you today will be on as well, but also a lot of crypto educational videos. And the good news is now all the videos now are available in French, Arabic, Mandarin, and Spanish as well. So thank you for joining us today. And thank you, Hugh, again for being with us today on this episode of the Future Money Podcast. And see you all next time.